We need to see the other point of view. I like seeing it in this format. It's entertaining. It just takes me a couple of seconds to absorb it. Even if I don't agree with it, at least I'm kind of amused by it. Or if I'm angry, it's okay. And overwhelmingly, people said, keep the current left-right format. So that gave me some hope for the country.
My name is Linda Laurel, and I'm asking you to have the courage to listen with an open mind to all of our voices, because our voices matter.
Hi, everybody. It's Linda Laurel. Welcome to another episode of Our Voices Matter podcast. My guest today is Nick Anderson, a Pulitzer Prize-winning op-ed journalist who used to work for the Houston Chronicle. That's how I got to know him here in Houston. He had kind of a difficult exit from there a few years ago, went through quite a bit, and had a lot of lessons learned, which he shares with us during our conversation today. But I'm happy to say Nick has come out on the other side, and he is doing some amazing work that I believe has the ability to truly help bring us together as a country. And, you know, that's what this podcast is all about. So I'm excited for you to take part in our conversation. So here it is. Enjoy. Nick, it is great to see you. It's been many years since we've had a chance to chat. I have been a fan of your work for as long as I can remember. I've been in the market, I think, in Houston longer than you have. But I miss seeing you in the Houston Chronicle, but you are still out there doing your thing with your amazing cartoons. So tell me how and what you're doing now. In terms of how you are communicating what is going on in this world through your very unique medium.
So the transition away from newspapers was a little rocky, but I've managed to find a pretty good base right now. I'm doing a lot. I'm only doing three cartoons a week for syndication. I changed syndicates in January from Washington Post to Tribune Content Agency, but my work is getting out there. It's probably being seen more than ever through syndication and social media. But yeah, I've got to do a lot of other things to make ends meet. I'm working for the mayor's office. I'm a communications professional for the government relations department. I'm a mortgage loan originator.
So life has taken some twists and turns these last few years, huh?
It's taken a lot. But the editorial cartooning, I've got some projects going that are very, very exciting.
Okay, so I want to back up and ask you, because I definitely want to explore all of that, but I want to back up and ask you what your path was to becoming an editorial cartoonist. What is your backstory, if you can briefly help our listeners and viewers understand how you got to where you are?
So my father was a scientist. He was a biochemist. And my birth mother was an artist. So I have this kind of strange combination of left brain, right brain, where I'm very analytical and very creative at the same time. I'm not really sure which is more dominant. Probably a little bit more creative, but there are times when I'm not sure. So, and I was also the youngest of 11 kids.
Wow.
I lost my mother when I was really young at age 4, but my dad remarried a couple of years later and brought in 4 more stepkids. So of all of those kids, the birth kids and his birth kids and my step siblings, I was the youngest of 11. So I think I always kind of wanted to be a little different and to separate myself from the crowd, because there was a crowd. And I started drawing a lot and started drawing cartoons. And I bought a book on cartooning when I was, I think, in sixth grade. And it was just how to draw cartoons. And my older brother told me he would make fun of me. I don't even remember. But he would give me a hard time because he's like, this family is a family of managers, not cartoonists, not artists. And so... But for some reason, I always knew who I was and knew that I just did what I thought, what I wanted to do. It would made me feel, you know, at peace with myself. So I started doing these cartoons. And by high school, I would look at the paper every day. And in order to get to the comic strips, I would pass through the editorial page. And I noticed these beautifully drawn editorial cartoons. And I was just captivated by them. I was like, wow, in just one panel, you can communicate an opinion and do it so quickly. I'm like, that's what I want to do. I didn't really know much about politics at the time, but I was really captivated by that whole idea. So I started trying them, and I did them for my high school paper, and it really just sort of took off. For 4 years, I did them for my high school paper, and then I became obsessed with becoming an editorial cartoonist, which was really strange. And my dad, being a scientist, would laugh, and he'd say, the mathematical odds of you becoming an editorial cartoonist are very small. He used to always say, you can fit all the editorial cartoonists in a phone booth in this country. But you may as well just become an MBA star. But I was not very good at math, so I just kept going. And I ended up going to Ohio State because it had the largest student newspaper. And they had a program about editorial cartooning, just a part-time class. And I'm like, this just seems like, and I was from Ohio, so I was like, this just seems like a great fit. And they had had a bunch of good editorial cartoonists, but the last one graduated out just as I was coming in. So I sent my portfolio in and landed the job at the Ohio State newspaper my freshman year in college. So it all sort of happened very, very well for me. Yeah.
And I love that you figured out really early on what your passion was and that you followed it, you know, even in the face of those kind of odds. Those are the same kind of odds of somebody wanting to become a professional athlete. You know, mm-hmm. The parents say, you know, the chances of you actually getting that, being on a pro football team or a pro basketball team or whatever are like this small. Right. So what did your dad say when you made it into this profession?
He was the first person I called.
I'll bet.
when I got a job offer, and he was thrilled for me. He was always my biggest skeptic in the sense that he wanted to protect me. He would say, "You know, go ahead and follow your passion, but make sure you have a backup plan." So he said, "College degree, something that will, you know, that you can rely on." So he was thrilled, and he was my biggest fan for years. He would he was kind of a Reagan Republican. And he had a really good sense of humor and was very supportive. And I've kind of made this transition from very centrist to pretty hard left the past 15 years. And he was somebody, he's passed, but he really believed in the American system and the wisdom of the forefathers. And so I had to take this kind of rainbows and unicorns attitude about our political system, and gradually I've grown more cynical and angry. And I'm probably most disgusted and angry. I think even now he would be appalled at our political system.
So let's talk about this. You said your dad was a Reagan Republican, mm-hmm. and you have moved increasingly to the left over mm-hmm. time. So how did you handle that relationship with your father, and you know, being such an intimate relationship and having opposing, which sounds like you had opposing political views. So how was that relationship handled at that time? And then how do you think you would be handling it now, given, you know, the environment that we're living in, if your dad were here still with us?
So we never argued about politics in a way that was, he would never get upset. He would laugh at my cartoons. He would laugh really loud. And then he might say, I don't agree with it, but this is what you're supposed to be doing. So he was very supportive of the idea of satire and, you know, poking, telling truth to power, whatever you want to say it, but challenging the authorities. He was very supportive of that. But gradually he started to change too. When Clinton was president, he became very angry at the Republicans because he liked Clinton. And he's like, why do they want to impeach him over this silliness? He started feeling like the Republican Party was already starting to lose its way during the Clinton years. And I think now he would be appalled at where the Republican Party has gone. He was a centrist Republican. And I think I'm a centrist Democrat, but I think the Republican Party has gone so nutty that even a centrist Democrat can appear to be hard left. So anyway.
So how do you view your ability to take what is going on in the political realm and create cartoons that then foster conversation. What is your goal when you decide to put something out there?
So my goal is to provoke, provoke thought and discussion. Sometimes they provoke laughter, sometimes they provoke anger, but hopefully either way, it'll make you think. And when people get angry at me and send me angry emails, I feel a sense of satisfaction because I've accomplished my goal of at least getting them thinking and engaged. And in fact, one of the things I miss about being at the newspaper is I used to get way more angry emails when I worked at the newspaper and I miss those. Yeah. That's my goal, is to just provoke thought.
And so when you get those angry emails, do you engage? Do you respond? How do you deal with that?
I used to, and I would maybe debate them a little bit. I would never get angry in return or try to get nasty. Now I just don't have the time. I get a lot of more positive comments because I'm on Patreon and I have a Substack email. And then social media, Facebook, Twitter. And so mostly what I get is positive. It's people that follow my work and really like it. And I regret that I don't have time to engage as much because I'm just working so much. I do my cartoons in my free time. I'm managing a newsletter called Counterpoint, which I'd love to talk about. It's very exciting.
Yes, yes. I definitely want to do that. So to back up for our listeners and viewers to understand, so you were with the Houston Chronicle for a number of years. And in 2017, you were laid off because they literally eliminated your position, right?
Yes, they did.
So talk to me about that time in your life. How you dealt with that, how you were able to deal with it and overcome it and move forward, because I know it hasn't been easy.
No, it was the toughest couple of years of my life. I was engaged at the time. My current wife at the time has two boys of her own. I have two boys. And so we felt like we needed some room before we got married. So we bought a house, a 4-bedroom house. We bought inside the Loop where we felt like we could afford. But 6 days after we closed on the house, I lost my job. I'm like, oh no. We hadn't moved yet. And like, I'm like sitting on the couch in shock. Like instead of packing, I had all my cartoonist friends were calling to check on me. So I spent a lot of time on the phone. And so the move was just absurd. We moved 2 weeks later and the packing was not completely done. And so we ran out of boxes and started throwing stuff in garbage bags. And the hilarious thing is when we started unpacking, we found literal bags of garbage that we had paid movers to move. Like the fries coming out because they couldn't tell the difference between the garbage and
the stuff you wanted to move, right?
A cascading set of, but I had an old 4Runner. It got broken into a couple of days after we moved. There's like glass all over so I'm driving this thing around with a broken window because I have no time to fix it. We had just a cascading set of bad things happen, like pipes bursting even before the winter storm. Hurricane Harvey hit 6 weeks after I lost my job. So I literally, thank God I didn't lose power because I was working every day through Hurricane Harvey. Because I started getting freelance work and it didn't come close to paying my bills. I would say for the first year and a half, I made about 35% of what I had made before. And it was working 60 to 80 hours a week.
Oh my gosh.
I was working constantly and still burning through. I had a lot of savings, but I was burning through at an alarming rate. So I won't get too far into the details because there's so many things that happened. It was kind of Murphy's Law. That was like everything that could go wrong kept going wrong. And my wife and I were like, how long can we endure this? But the nice thing is we got married in 2018. We decided to go ahead with the marriage. And things started changing after that. Our luck is late 2018. And then I landed the job at the mayor's office, which has been just great. I really like working for Mayor Turner. I like the job and it gave us medical, which is huge. So things have gradually gotten significantly better. And then we can talk about Counterpoint when you're ready.
Yeah. So before we go there, what did you learn from that experience? You know, part of what this podcast is about is helping, you know, sharing stories like this, you know, because everybody's got, you know, shit, stuff that happens in their lives. And, you know, we all have to figure out how to keep moving forward and putting one foot in front of the other. And the hope is that, you know, somebody resonates, you know, your story resonates with someone, and maybe they, you know, hear you say that you're a far left liberal, but they can relate to, mm-hmm. you know, what you just went through because they've been through something like that. So I'm trying to find some commonality, you know, within our audience. And so, and then I want to know what you learned from that, that's helping you show up in the world the way you are now.
So, yeah, I'm glad you asked. And there were challenges that I'm not even getting into. It was like living through a nightmare. I couldn't believe how many things were going badly. And after about a year and a half, when in my kid's bedroom, their bathroom, my son came in and I was trying to get work done. He's like, "Dad, there's water shooting up."
And you're like, "Of course there is.
Of course there is. Yeah, it's just another. It's a day that ends in Y. So something bad is happening." And we had this like sculpture in the hallway that was on the landing, and I took it and I just smashed it. And it was like this sort of knit sculpture, so it wasn't like shattering, but I just beat the heck out of it. And I did it in front of my son. And later on, I was like, "I'm really sorry I lost it, Bernie, but I totally understand you can't catch a break." So that was a very vivid memory. And there were times when I would wake up. I had nightmares almost every night. I would wake up, and the fire was a big theme in my dreams. I kept having dreams of me and my family stuck in a house fire. And that's how it felt. It felt very trapped. And it wasn't like, we still had a nice house. I could have sold it and moved to an apartment or something like that. Or I also was in a custody arrangement with my son who was 16 at the time. And I had to be near his school to get, and I had him 50% of the time. So I had to get him to school. And if I moved to the suburbs, I wouldn't be able to see him as much. And it's important to me to be a part of my son's life. So I felt very trapped in this house that I had just bought. And so I was trying to just hold it all together because I kept thinking it will get better, I hope. But it actually just kept getting worse. But the lesson I learned is just put your head down and keep moving forward. There were times when I thought it's never going to get better. People kept saying it's going to get better. And I kept telling my wife, but it's not, it's getting worse. And she would try to, my wife is somebody, she tries to fix everything. And she would try to fix it and try to say, it's going to get better. And I'd be like, you're making me feel worse because it's not getting worse. And so she learned just listen when somebody's going through that. And for me, I'm very honest with myself. I don't, if there's not silver linings or things aren't getting better, I don't say it is. I'm like, look, I lost my job. I'm no longer a journalist. That was my lifelong dream. You have to give me space to mourn this. I just have to process this, and I may have to go do something else, and I may have to give this up entirely. I almost did give up editorial cartooning entirely. Yeah. And so she just listened a lot and was there for me to support me. And I just kept putting one foot in front of the other and just kept, I just had faith that if I kept doing that, it would eventually, the storm would eventually pass. And it did, but man, it was a much longer time than I expected.
I love both of those lessons on your part, to put one foot in front of the other, put your head down and keep going. I had a friend once put it to me like this when I was going through a really rough time. And she said, "Linda, just take the next best step. That's all you have to do. Just keep, you know, one foot in front of the other." And then the other lesson about your wife just listening, you know, and that is such a huge thing. As a rule, we have stopped listening to each other in general terms as a society. We're not listening. We're judging. We're prejudging. Mm-hmm. We are in our silos and we're not, we're so consumed with trying to refute somebody else's point of view without really listening to whatever it is they have to say. Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
So you're taking a point of view in your cartoons, and you mentioned Counterpoint. So tell us what Counterpoint is and how we can support what you're doing now.
Counterpoint's very, very exciting. So a year after I lost my job, a guy named Rob Rogers, a cartoonist for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, got fired for doing anti-Trump cartoons. And it was very public. He went public with it and did interviews on CNN, and his newspaper was public about it. They didn't want him. They were Trump supporters, and he was doing a lot of critical Trump cartoons, is you know, one would think if you're on that. And so he ended up getting fired because he wouldn't stop doing them because he wanted to be true to himself. So it got international attention because he was willing to talk about it publicly. And so it was all over Twitter. My friends were messaging me saying, "Hey, have you heard about this?" I'm like, "Yeah, I know Rob." And it was New York Times covered it. I think the Washington Post covered it. A lot of TV stations covered it. International newspapers covered it. So it was getting all this attention. So I wrote a message to the board of the Association of American Editorial Cartoonists, and I used to be an officer for that organization. I said, "Hey, this is an opportunity to talk about what's happening to editorial cartooning at large, not just one guy. Everyone's paying attention. People have been getting fired for political reasons for 20 years, but it wasn't public. It was always kept quiet because we're troublemakers." And a lot of newspapers, especially when times are tough, they're like, "Why are we paying this guy to get us canceled subscriptions?" So, and you know, it's hard to know whether people do cancel their subscriptions because of us or threaten to, and it's hard to know whether it's a value add or not. I think it's a value add, but they were, you know, they started to make a calculation that political cartoonists weren't worth the trouble. So we have been decimated. There's like 25 paid staff cartoonists in the country. There's zero in Texas. I mean, a state of nearly 30 million people doesn't have a single full-time.
At the height, how many were there? You said there are 25 in the country now. How many were there?
The number is approaching 200, maybe 175. You know, when I got into it in the 70s, that was really the golden era. 70s, early 80s, probably 70s, 80s are probably like close to 200. And so now there's like 25. And so there's a lot of us still doing freelance, but yeah, it's a lot tougher now. So when the officers, the president of the AAC read my email and he said, "You know, this reads more like a column. Why don't you try to get it published somewhere?" So I remembered, Jake Tapper at CNN follows me on Twitter. Now, Jake Tapper was a cartoonist in college. So he's a former cartoonist.
I love seeing his cartoons at the end of his show on Sunday.
Yes, they're great. Yeah. So I sent him a direct message and I said, "I'd like to write about this." And so he connected me with their opinion section, and they looked at it and they worked with me to make it more like a column. And it got published later that week. So the next day, I get a LinkedIn friend request from this guy named Vivek Garipalli. He's a CEO of a healthcare company. And I'm like, "Well, that's odd." This may be the only time that LinkedIn has ever been at all beneficial to me, but this one was huge. So I'm like, "Well, that's curious." And I accept it. And he immediately messages me and said, "Hey, I saw your column on CNN.com. I was really taken with it. Can we talk?" And I'm like, "Well, sure." And so he sets up a time to call to talk later that week. And he's like, "You know, I've been really interested in doing a media website for years because I read everything from far left to far right." He's a consumer of news and tries to get perspective from all over the place and feels like we're too siloed in our media landscape, and is passionate about doing something that we're, you bring left and right together and you're honest about it, and that there's no such thing as unbiased news, which I think is true. You cannot cover the news in an unbiased way. You're going to bring your values to it. So he just said, let's just be honest about it. So instead of a news or opinion site, why don't we do something with cartoons? And I was like, this sounds great. And I'm like, but I have to warn you, cartoons are really hard to monetize because they're all over social media. People just take them. They copy and paste them and they put them on Twitter or Reddit or Facebook. And you can get them taken down if you own the copyright. But it's usually like, it's really tedious. You have to go fill out a form. And there's like the horse is already out of the barn. Mm-hmm. So social media is a double-edged sword. Our stuff is seen all over the place, but we can't monetize it. We're just getting killed because of it. So I said, I have to warn you, there's this problem. And he goes, oh, that's okay. We'll just set like aside $4 or $5 million for a litigation budget. And I was like, what?
I will just set aside $4 or $5 million.
Like, okay, I'm talking to somebody with serious
money. Who's like, excuse me again, who are you?
Yeah, exactly. And I'm like, is somebody punking me? Is this real? So he's a owner of a Clover Capital or Clover Health, and he's also a venture capitalist. He's a kind of an insurance guy, but also a Silicon Valley guy. So he goes, why don't you come to my house next week and we'll have a meeting? Why don't you buy a ticket to New York and then we'll reimburse you and we'll get you to my house in the Hamptons. And I'm like, okay.
Really?
I'm like, I'm unemployed. I'm self-employed. I'm making enough money to scrape by. And you want me to buy $1,000 ticket and hope I get so I was like, I wasn't really believing. I was like, somebody's messing, because everything had been so horrible.
Yeah.
Like, this just has to be another trick because it's
not well. I'm being scammed. I'm totally.
Yeah, I thought I was being scammed. So I checked him on LinkedIn again. We had one mutual connection. So I called him and he goes, oh yeah, I used to work for him for 3 years. He says he's going to do something. He's going to do it. Take him. I was like, wow. Okay. So, I booked the ticket, but I was still really nervous and I got them to reimburse me right away before the 24 hour period. I'm like, please? So they did. And I'm like, okay, this is real. Mm-hmm. So I get there and he has a driver pick me up and, you know, holding my name up and drives me in a nice Mercedes to the Hamptons. And here I am sitting on his back patio on the Hamptons, after all this carnage and talking about editorial cartooning and what we can do. So I ended up bringing in two of my friends in the area. So we had a brainstorming. I had an initial session with Vivek and then we brought in two more of my friends for a sort of a brainstorming session. And then he flew us back to Manhattan in a helicopter.
Oh my God. What? I know you must have thought, okay, I'm living in an alternate universe here. What is going on?
This is so weird. What is it? This can't be happening. This helicopter ride costs more than my mortgage this month, I'm sure. But okay, I'll take it. So in fits and starts, it took a while to get to the newsletter model. I went to New York for another brainstorming session. And there were several times when I thought this is not going to happen. Because he's a busy guy. I would stop hearing from him, and his initial ideas, I think, were closer to syndication model. And I'm like, that's a dead model too. That's not going to work because syndicates are having trouble too. So we ended up with this newsletter as just sort of a pilot. Let's just see what kind of interest there is. It was a very low investment, experiment. And then, so it took several months for it to get off the ground, probably another 6 months. And so when we finally did it, it was important to me that we pay cartoonists for original work, not just have a newsletter where we collect cartoons.
Right.
Because the problem is syndication pays terrible. So we could create a newsletter like this for very little with just recycled content that has already been run elsewhere. But I was passionate that we pay cartoonists something that helps them pay their bills.
Yeah.
And it's original content. So he's putting up money to pay cartoonists for original content. They, in exchange, they can't use it anywhere else for a day. And right now we have this cool template where every day there's a liberal cartoon and a conservative cartoon, and then they write a little something with it. It's the cartoon, what the cartoonist is thinking behind. Okay. So that's kind of a value add that you can't get anywhere else.
Right.
And it's really taken off. We have 170,000 free subscribers right now. You can get a free subscription. And it just grew like wildfire for the first year. We were adding 10,000 subscribers a week. So when we market, we just add subscribers like crazy. But now we have this sort of hybrid where we charge for, if you want to see it every day, we charge a little, like $5 a month. So it's not much. And then if you want it for free, you get it Tuesdays and Thursdays for free. Mm-hmm. And so we're kind of covering some of our costs, but we're looking at some new partnerships right now where we can monetize more advertising and some other ideas to monetize. And I think it's going to work. And so we're decoupling our fates from the newspaper model and trying to create something completely new. And the interest is there. And something really great happened. I started thinking, we're so polarized. People aren't going to want this because they don't want to see the other point of view. And we got some feedback like that. People said, I canceled because I didn't want to see that jerk from the other side. I was tired of it. So we did a reader poll. And overwhelmingly positive. People said, like 90% of respondents. We had a lot of respondents and hundreds of comments saying, no, keep the current model. I love it. We need to see the other point of view. I like seeing it in this format. It's entertaining. It just takes me a couple of seconds to absorb it. Even if I don't agree with it, at least I'm kind of amused by it. Or if I'm angry, it's okay. And overwhelmingly, people said, keep the current left-right format. So that gave me some hope for the country.
That gives me hope. I love this story. I love this. And just the thought of people saying, I canceled my subscription because I don't even want to see the other side. That is the problem.
That's the problem.
That is the problem. We're not seeing the other side. And because the media landscape has, I would say, devolved, has evolved, pick your word, into what it is. Mm-hmm. You don't have to see the other point of view if you don't want to. And right. That is just making the problem worse. Day by day. Mm-hmm. So what an interesting concept and way to come at this problem, this challenge facing our society from the cartoonist perspective and entertainment perspective. I love it. I really hope this takes off. I'm going to subscribe for sure.
Right.
And so what's the long game on this? What's your pie in the sky? What are you hoping?
So pie in the sky, we've looked at some other newsletter models and we're looking at one that has 1.5 million subscribers and it's advertising based. We can get there. I have no doubt that we can get there. If we go back to a marketing the newsletter and trying to get subscriptions, which costs us some money, but it's not terrible. We basically need advertising so that we can get there. And because we were growing so fast, all we did was put ads on Facebook and we were growing 10,000 subscribers a week. I think it was a week. So I am confident we can get there. So we're about to partner with a consultant that I think can get us to the next level. And I feel like the sky is the limit. I like that we're charging a little bit for the premium right now, but I would prefer to give it away for free and just have an ad supported newsletter where we can have over a million subscribers, which I think is completely realistic given how fast we were growing. It's free. It's entertaining. It just takes a few minutes of your time. Oh, and by the way, our open rate is really high for a newsletter. Newsletter open rates are around 12 to 15%. Ours is around 30 to 40%. Depending on what's going on at the time, we get a higher open rate when there's more going on. So our engagement level is high. I'm optimistic about where we go from here. We just have to get a few pieces in place.
So I would assume that you did a cartoon or two after the January 6th riot at the Capitol.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So tell us a little bit about what you came up with and what your thought process was.
So I've done a lot of I've used the image of the QAnon shaman a lot, the guy with the horns.
Oh, yeah.
And a lot of cartoonists have picked up on that guy. Mm-hmm. And I've drawn him a lot on, like, the Republican elephant. It's one of the most appalling moments in my lifetime. It's just appalling that this happened. And I thought this was going to be the turning point. I thought, finally, chickens have come home to roost, and the Republicans are going to, and he's no longer president, they're going to start distancing themselves. And they tried to, and then they backpedaled. I don't know where the bottom is. So I'm very afraid for where our country is, because I feel like we have one party that is willing to sacrifice everything to maintain power.
Power.
Mm-hmm. And I think it comes from a bad place. I think it's, I think there's this existential dread among people who've had power for so long and are losing this status that they've long held. And this whole cancel culture thing, I think, is emblematic of that. They're so angry about cancel culture, and yet for decades, they were the ones canceling other people's cultures. And now it's happening to them, and they're just like, they're appalled and angry. I'm like, but
how dare you? Yeah.
How dare you? I mean, they demanded that Colin Kaepernick be fired for respectfully kneeling. Mm-hmm. He wasn't even being disrespectful. Mm-hmm. It was a silent, mm-hmm. respectful mm-hmm. protest.
And took his career away. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So to me, it's very troubling. And if you look at the Electoral College vote, Biden barely won. I know he won by 7 million votes, but I saw an analysis that 55,000 votes in three key states switched the other way, and Trump would have had a second term. Mm-hmm. And it's very troubling, because it's Trump is very dishonest. I think he's very, very dangerous, and people believe what he says when he's lying and says,
and he's still there because the Senate did not have the guts to convict.
Yeah.
And so as we're doing this interview, CPAC is happening.
Yes.
And the former president will have a national stage tomorrow. And already, you know, Mitch flip-flop McConnell has, you know, after chastising the president on the floor, after voting not to convict, and then saying, oh, but he's, you know, he's probably still guilty, but I just, you know, whatever he said.
Yeah.
The whole procedural, you know, BS argument.
Right.
And now is saying, oh, well, you know, if he were to be the nominee in 2024, I would support him. What the hell?
I know.
How do you even?
Makes your head explode.
It does. It makes my head want to explode. I mean, what is the, it's like you said, where's the bottom?
Yeah.
Where's the bottom? And then how, I was having a conversation yesterday with someone who is in the Republican Party, you know, and described himself as a disillusioned Republican, mm-hmm. you know, not at all a Trump supporter, really, you know, sort of like, what is going on with the party? What is the role, do you think, for people like that, who want to, for lack of a better term, bring the party to its senses? What do you think is their role, or can be their role, in trying to have some sort of corrective action here?
I think it's a great question. And the Lincoln Project really, they tried to do that. And the Lincoln Project, I think, did some absolutely devastating ads, and their social media was really strong. But I don't think it's been enough. Mm-hmm. I almost think they have to start a third party.
That was going to be my next question, is if you think that's going to happen. Is that even realistic?
I think it's realistic under the current circumstances, because those people are just as appalled as we are about what's happening to the Republican Party. And the Republican Party is no longer the traditional conservative Reagan Republican Party that it was. The Republican Party has to be hurt for this to change. And they really didn't pay much of a price during the election. Lindsey Graham got reelected. Mitch McConnell got reelected. They gained seats in the House. So they, and they really wanted to get rid of Trump. So they kind of had the best of both worlds for them, the establishment Republicans. So playing this double game has worked for them. So until it stops working for them, they're going to keep doing it. So I think a third party would help split off votes. And for those people who don't want to vote for Democrats and think that Democrats are social, will bring bring socialist oblivion upon us, which is nonsense. But for those that feel that way, at least it would give them a place to go. And maybe that party would grow over time. I don't know how it's either that or these people have to die. I mean, let's face it, a lot of the people who feel
they are up in age.
They're white, older Americans. Yeah. And until they age out, we might be stuck with this.
So in the meantime, what do you think the Democrats should be doing that they're not doing? How are you viewing where the Democratic Party is now that Biden is in office? Because I, you know, there are some who are saying they should be playing hardball a lot more than they are. They're too much trying to make nice and, you know, go down the whole bipartisan route, which is, you know, how he got elected. What do you think? Do you think they're doing the right things right now, or do you think they should be taking a little bit of a different approach?
I think they're doing the right things. It can be a mistake to look at politics and left right, because if you do that, you can say the left should be doing what the right's doing because it's working for them. But I think it's better to look at it as progress versus status quo. If you push too much progress on America too quickly, they freak out. We've seen that over and over again. And what you don't want to do, the left often loses because the right convinces everyone that the left is scary. And they'll turn us.
And they're really good at doing that. They're really good at doing that.
And so when you play into that messaging, which they're so good at, you're doing them a favor. So when Biden I think he's doing the right thing, being more centrist, at least mostly in his rhetoric. He had some. I'm totally in agreement with his changes on climate. But I think overall he's trying to take a centrist approach where you don't play into the boogeyman stereotype. And I think that if he keeps doing that, he'll get reelected, or Kamala Harris will, which is what I hope happens, that she'll be the next president. 'Cause he's going to be getting up there in age. Mm-hmm. So I think the left always has to be more centrist. I think that's the burden in order to win. And I think that's what Clinton understood. And he constantly outmaneuvered the Republicans. It was the opposite then. They would constantly play into his traps. He was a master at setting traps for them, and they were so extreme, they would constantly do it. So I think Biden is pretty shrewd, and he understands that, and we'll try to change the game.
So while the parties are doing what they do, what do you think the average person should be doing? What can we do as citizens of this country, assuming that we all love it? You know, we're all coming at it, as you said, with our, you know, there is no such thing as unbiased news. We all have our biases. We all bring our sets, our value sets, our, you know, the way we were brought up. We all bring all of that to the table. What I'm trying to do with this podcast is to bring it down to the grassroots level, to the everyday person, and say, okay, you know, those guys are going to do what, you know, the politicians are going to do what they do. And, you know, policy is one thing. And yes, we need policy. Yes, we need structure and all of that. But the bottom line is it all of this comes down to human communication and human connection. Mm-hmm. And we are failing miserably at it. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts on that and how we can start to do a little bit better at that?
I love that question. Yeah, because we tend to focus on what the politicians are doing and blame them. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, as we've discussed, I think get yourself out of your comfort zone a little bit and expose yourself to different news sources. And maybe consider the possibility that they're not as biased as you've been told, or even if they are, they may be factual. The mainstream media, the dreaded mainstream media, has had this rap for years that they're liberal. And I think there's some truth to it. They bring often maybe a liberal news value, but that doesn't mean it's not factual. And often it gets caricatured into something much worse than it is. And I think the reason I love Counterpoint so much is it takes me out of my comfort zone. And, you know, I'm running it, and there's often cartoons in there that I think I'm like, are you gotta be kidding me? This is ridiculous. And I'm like, but that's the point. My only thing that I insist on is cartoons. I like that I disagree with them, but I want them to be fact-based. There've been a couple times where there were cartoons that were playing into what I think is the lie that Trump won the election. I'm like, this is a lie that is damaging to our democracy. And I want Counterpoint to be beneficial to democracy by getting both sides, but not promoting dishonest things.
So how did you handle that when you saw that cartoon?
In this, so we let a few go early on because it was before all the recounts got, and I thought, you know, all of that was okay, kind of ridiculous, but I let them go. So we don't actually have an editor, and that's the way it's set up. We have, the only mechanism we have to stop a cartoon is by taking a vote. A majority of cartoonists have to vote against the cartoon, and it's only happened twice. Most of us, if we're challenged, we'll just say, oh, okay, I'll just do something else. If people are like, this, you're going over the line here. But some have pushed the line more. In this case, there are two of us who just spoke up, who said, this cartoon is promoting a lie. Like, I don't care that I disagree with most of your work, but it's based on something that is completely untrue and is damaging to and dangerous.
The democracy. Yeah.
And dangerous and absolutely dangerous to convince people that the election was stolen. Mm-hmm. And so the person who submitted the sketch. So we submit sketches and we have this Slack channel where we all talk. And he ended up, because he had lost a couple times before, he's like, yeah, I'm not fighting this one again. I'll do something different. So we stopped that one just by challenging him. We didn't end up taking a vote. Which is, the Slack channel is like a whole nother discussion. We work as a team. We have 16 cartoonists left and right, and we have to work together. And we have this Slack channel that's going all the time where we submit sketches before we publish them. And sometimes the person will see the sketch and then draw a counterpoint to it. We don't have to draw on the same topic, but oftentimes we do. And so we have to, it's been great to see how well we work together for the most part. There's, even if we disagree with the cartoon, a cartoonist will say, hey, that's great. Or if they submit three sketches, we'll say, I like this one the best, even though I can't stand it. It's the strongest one for Counterpoint. So that's been really cool to see people who disagree politically work together for an end product. And it gives me a little hope.
I love that, because what you just said, that we might disagree, but we think it's best. It's what's best for Counterpoint. Mm-hmm. So if you take that argument and broaden it out to our country, it's, I might disagree with you, but mm-hmm. this is what's best for the country,
yeah.
not for my party, not for my side, for my opinion. It's best for all of us. We've lost that sense of caring for each other within the context of the common good. It's become so much more about my personal rights. This is what's best for me as an individual who believes this, and how dare you trample on my rights, mm-hmm. not even thinking about how that fits into the whole of everyone's rights and what's best for the country.
Yeah.
I love this. I love this whole concept of Counterpoint.
I do too. And it's been an education for me. I was very skeptical because it wasn't my idea to have both sides. If I had created my own thing, it would have been a bunch of liberal cartoonists. But Vivek, he's a really brilliant guy. And I'm not just saying that because he's funding this. He was adamant that whatever we did, both sides represented equally. And I was skeptical that the business model would work, but he's being proven right. And it's what we need as a country. And I think there's probably a good business model there as well, because people are really reacting well to it and want it to continue. So it's given me some hope.
I am all about hope. And I am so happy to have had you talk so in depth about this on this platform, because this is, you know, this is exactly what we need, is to be able to come together, look at different points of view, not necessarily always agree, but then say, hey, you know, that was funny. I get it. And the fact that you guys are all working together and having to figure out how to do that, knowing full well that you're coming from different points of view, and then say, okay, this is what's best for the company. And this is what we can then take and put out into the universe for everybody else. Mm-hmm. That gives me hope. So thank you for that.
You're great.
Oh my goodness. So I want to wrap up, but before I do that, I have to go back to one thing you said. You mentioned that you agree with us coming back into the Paris Climate Accord. Mm-hmm. Climate was a big topic, still is a big topic here in Texas, you know, with everything that happened with the Arctic blast and the power grid and everything. What kind of a cartoon are you thinking of doing as it relates to climate and what is happening here locally?
So I've done four or five already. So I have to be, because I work for the mayor and we work for local politicians, I'm very limited in what I can do about Ted Cruz or John Cornyn, because we work with their offices. In fact, I was on a call this week with Cruz's office and I was just taking notes, but still I can't compromise the it would be a conflict of interest, but I can do more broad Texas themes. So I really let loose. And my first cartoon was the Texas cowboy, you know, don't mess with Texas, energy capital of the world. And then he's screaming because there's a snowflake dropping and just one single snowflake is terrifying him. It's like, how can this state, which is supposed to be so ruggedly individual and the energy capital of the world, be suffering this mm-hmm. fate? Mm-hmm. And so I've done another one about deregulation. The deregulation Kool-Aid was frozen solid because they have unquestionably accepted this theory that deregulation solves everything and the magic of the market will bring us lower prices and efficiency. And I found it so amusing that I was watching one of the state hearings on Thursday, which is part of my job, was taking notes for this hearing on what happened. And one of the legislators was demanding to know who was at fault of the energy producers. And it's like, you're at fault. The state legislature set this up.
Hello, look in the mirror.
the ERCOT answers to the PUC, which answers to the governor and the state legislature. They set this up and they believe that no less regulation was better. And I grew up in Northern Ohio. We never lost power that I can remember, or if we did, it was just for a very short time. Yep. This is ridiculous. This is a lack of regulation. It's inefficient to winterize. It's inefficient to have regulation. But now we just learned why. Because it is more expensive to not prepare for this. This is exceeding Hurricane Harvey's cost. Yeah. So now all the pennies we saved on electricity, if any, the Wall Street Journal had a story this week saying it actually cost more than the regulated system. But even if you accept the argument that we saved a little bit, we just paid for it in burst pipes and many times over.
Oh, I know. And I'm so last night I was watching the news and it said, Gritty out of business, you know, and I'm a Gritty customer.
They've
got thousands of dollars of my money already because they were drawing it out of my bank account.
Oh no!
As this was happening, and finally I switched from the debit card to a credit card, and you know we've been leaving messages for them for days and getting nothing in return, and now they're barred from doing business. I have no idea. Maybe there's a snowball's chance that I'll get some of my money back. I don't know.
Yeah.
But it's just, you know, government matters, you know, elections matter. People need to pay attention. People need to be involved. People need to be engaged. And we need to figure out how to talk to each other again in a civil manner, and agree that it's okay to disagree without demonizing each other.
Exactly. Couldn't agree more.
Yeah. So, Nick, this has been a pleasure. And we are going to link to Counterpoint and anything else you want us to link to in the show notes of our page. And we're going to spread this information far and wide. And I wish you and your family the best. And I cannot wait to see what happens with Counterpoint going into the future. I think it's really important for our country.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
Thank you. So many terrific nuggets that Nick had to share with us. I hope you enjoyed listening to him as much as I enjoyed talking with him. We, of course, are going to link to counterpoint.com in the show notes. Please go check it out and subscribe if you're able to. I know he would really appreciate that. I think it's such an important medium to help bring us together as we continue this conversation. Thank you so much for taking the time to give him permission to speak and for having the courage to listen with an open mind. If you like what we're doing here on our Voices Matter podcast, please subscribe to us on your platform of choice. Like and share away. We look forward to seeing you next time. Take care.